Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petition and in the interest of MS and others.
Good morning, Your Honor. First of all, my last name is now Papania. Everybody has trouble with it. That's all right. No problem. I represent Shanna Strickland in this termination proceeding, Your Honor. Basically, I brought four issues for the court. The first two deal with the trial judge admitting orders that he had signed, that he had made findings, and it's these orders that he entered that we have a problem with. Rule 605
Didn't they need the orders to prove their case?
No, Your Honor, not the first two. As far as the second order, the mediation agreement, well, actually, there was one order in the first two that she takes out of the court. That was the only one that I could see in there that had any order to show that she disregarded the court's prior order. Basically, those orders talked about the judge found that she wasn't able to take care of a child, there wasn't anyone else to take care of a child, the children weren't safe at home, and basically she just couldn't provide for them.
What was, accepting as you say that those preliminary orders had findings in them that was basically testimony of the jury, and looked at those orders, what was left for the jury to decide? If the trial judge already decided that she was not capable of taking care of the children and that that she was allowing them to stay in conditions that were not for their safety, what was being left for the jury to decide?
That's kind of my question. I don't understand why they entered those orders like that. If the jury was going to determine all the facts of the case, whether those children, the mother-parent-child relationship should be terminated, they should have made all of the findings. The fact that the judge goes in and puts his stamp of approval on these orders, it doesn't comport with a fair trial. The facts that, as they laid out, they're in conflict. There are reasons yes and there are reasons no. And the facts are in dispute, but when the judge goes in and signs this order and puts it in before the jury, not only that, once the state introduced them and the judge allowed them in, she publishes them to the jury, right then, right there. And in it, it's those same findings, the same things that they have to determine. Now, the state has argued that, well, this is cumulative, there was other evidence. We don't know what that evidence was at that temporary orders hearing. All we know is that the judge's findings in that temporary order. As far as the specifics of what she did for the judge to make that, we're not sure of that. But
I was unclear about whether there was objection to that. Was there objection at the time?
No, Your Honor, there wasn't. The way I understand the rule, no objection needs to be lodged whenever the judge comes in and testifies. And testify, there's a lot of argument about that. What is testimony? Is it the admission of those documents? Does he have to get off the bench and go sit in the witness stand? There are cases go both ways, both of them. They just say different things. Some of them say, yeah, he has to come down to take the witness box, get sworn in, and testify. There are other ones that say, no, that's really not accurate. That's not what they meant, that he has to actually go take the witness stand. What it means is that the judge is sitting there giving the jury facts and findings that he's already made. That's the same as testimony, as far as I can see, as far as most of the case law provides. As far as the mediation agreement. We have this mediation agreement where the court orders in the mediation within a month of trial. They go to mediation, and down in our county, the mediation, they go through the same process. It's confidential. Nobody's going to be told what's going on. Nobody's going to know about what's happening here. Well, they turn around, they go to trial, they introduce the mediation agreement.
Surely the agreement, you don't think the agreement's public after it's signed? Everybody agrees.
The fact that I don't believe so. I think that gets past the authentication of the document. I still don't think it gets past the hearsay of what was going on in there.
Well, I mean, the agreement's not here. If A and B contract and agree to do thus and so, that's not hearsay. That's their agreement.
The agreement, as I saw it, made all the same findings that the jury was there to determine. She's going to get a house. She's going to get a job. This poor lady, I mean, obviously she's indigent. She has five children. She's 30 years old. Only one person's paying child support. For her to do all these things, that's, I think, a contract of adhesion. I don't remember contract law very well. I'd also also think there was an impossibility of performance considering my client's meager resources at the time, and for that matter, most of her life when she's had these children. The next argument that we're bringing up is whether she had to file a motion for new trial. This one here causes us some concern. The way I understand the case law is that in certain instances when the interests are so commanding that the court is willing to over or not look at the procedural aspects of it but get to the substantive part of it, there's I believe a couple of courts that said that, you know, you don't have to do that. Go ahead and present it to us. There's one where they terminated her on grounds not pled. Well, in this case, Ms. Strickland, she had asked her court-appointed attorney to protect her appellate rights. She wanted to appeal it. And basically, he told her it was too expensive. Well, I don't know why it was too expensive if he was court-appointed on it, but that's what her testimony was in the record. And it seems that under these circumstances, the difference between the preponderance of evidence and proof beyond a reasonable doubt, we put our clear and convincing in there. It's our position that clear and convincing leads toward the criminal aspect of your filing a motion for new trial, complaining of sufficiency of the evidence. We'd argue that the fact that she didn't file it, that would kind of go to her effective assistance of counsel claim. And at the same time, we'd also say that based on the severity and the finality of these types of actions, that she shouldn't have been required to under those circumstances. And the last one, ineffective assistance of counsel. We've argued that Ms. Strickland's trial counsel was ineffective for a variety of reasons. He didn't have the voir dire, charge conference, closing arguments. He didn't have any of that recorded. I don't know why. I don't see any sound.
What's the showing? Any showing of harm there? Any bystanders bill?
Your Honor, by the time I was appointed on the case, the time had gone. I was appointed on it, I think like 2 weeks after she filed a notice of appeal, then I was taken off of it. Then the Ninth District come back and said, have a hearing on it. And by the time I was actually appointed on the case, the bystander bill, the time for that had expired.
The Court of Criminal Appeals has said that that's not automatic harm by any means to not have these preliminary and ancillary matters recorded to it. Why should it be different in a termination case than it is in a criminal case?
I don't see any reason why they shouldn't be. I mean, I think it would be mandatory to have them recorded. To say that, well, you don't have to have them recorded, well, I think that's trial counsel's fault.
Otherwise, I mean, you're asking us to come out differently than our sister court has in criminal cases. You're saying they're wrong.
As far as the ineffective assistance counsel for not doing that?
Yes.
I understand that's what they're saying. I'm arguing that I'm saying it should have been done. That there's no reason not to do it. As the judge said, I don't have any way of putting on a bill of exceptions at this point or the time I was appointed.
Well, but is there error in the charge that you're claiming here?
No, Your Honor.
Then why would we need the charge conference, the record of the charge conference?
I don't know what was said. I'm trying to say he was ineffective for something I can't prove. I understand my argument's kind of tenuous at best.
But we can at least eliminate the charge conference. If there's no error in the charge and you're not claiming error, then it doesn't matter that the charge conference wasn't recorded. And there's no, you haven't alleged that there are any problems with the jury, that someone that was a felon is sitting on the jury now or anything like that. We haven't seen that in this record.
No, Your Honor.
And so we're trying to find something that would link, an error for a refusal to record to something that would cause harm. And I'm just having a tough time making that connection.
And by the time that there was any ability to do that, it was too late. There was no time to go out and do that at that time. But by the time I was actually on the case, it was too late to go back and try to supplement the record, try to find anything for any kind of juror misconduct or anything of that nature. The other issues that I believe Ms. Strickland's attorney failed to do was to file any alternative pleadings. I understand the state said, well, this is kind of one of those all or nothing deals. You can put it up there and if it doesn't stick, you get your kids. I can see that, but there was no reason not to under the circumstances of the case. There could have been alternative pleadings to allow Ms. Strickland to be a possessory conservator. I don't understand any reason why not to do it. I think he should have done it. And the worst thing I believe that happened in this case, as the way I read the record and as the way I view the evidence, is the failure to file the motion for new trial. By doing that, depending on how the court rules on, do you have to file a motion for new trial, complaining on insufficiency of the evidence, it would alter my argument. If by failing to do that, he basically foreclosed any type of issue that she could bring up based on the motion for new trial. And that just puts her in a position where she's unable to protect her appellate rights. I believe that was I had the biggest problem with that as far as reading the record and seeing what her attorney did.
So if we were to find that challenge doesn't need to be preserved by motion for new trial, does your effectiveness of counsel plan go away?
I would argue it regardless, because of just the failure to do certain things that I think should have been done in trial. There are other things that are outside the record that I know that it's inconsequential now, but I still believe there were several issues that her attorney could have done a better job, at least protected the record. I've argued that, well, should there be any Batson challenges? Well, I meant Batson and its progeny, any type of challenge based on sex, gender. There's no way to know that. There's no way to see it. And how to argue that something was wrong here, if you can't prove it, that's just one of my disagreements with the way he rendered her,
the way he represented her. What was the makeup of the jury?
I have no idea, Your Honor.
Yet you say that it was incompetent or ineffective because she didn't challenge Batson?
No, sir. No, sir, I'm not saying it was ineffective not to raise a Batson challenge. I'm saying that there is no way to determine whether a Batson challenge should have been raised, or any type of challenge that should have been raised during the board hour or during closing arguments. There's just no way to tell.
Okay. Don't they keep those records about who served on the jury? Yeah.
If they do, Your Honor, I don't have them. I didn't see them in the record.
I see.
Are you basing your right, that there's a right to effective assistance of counsel, on the U.S. Constitution, the Fifth Amendment? What's the source of the right?
Due process of the 14th.
14th Amendment. And does the right extend both to indigent and non-indigent parents, or is it just indigent?
I see no reason why it should not extend to both.
So in all of the cases involving parental termination, you're asking the court to undertake constitutional analysis and determine whether the lawyer was competent?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Just want to be clear.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please report, Mr.
Lee,
who is an argument to respond.
May it please the court. The issue here is not whether there's a constitutional question about due process. The issue here is what procedure, if any, is required under the state statutory construct as it exists right now when you appoint an indigent parent counsel under 107.013 of the Family Code. Now, I wrote down the questions that you asked in the previous oral argument on BLD, and if the court would, does not mind, I'm going to start with answering those questions. Justice Heck, you asked, what happens if someone comes in as an attorney, he's completely incompetent. He's absolutely drunk, knows nothing about the law, sleeping, whatever. Listen, the worst scenario. I think there are a couple of things that you need to look at when you ask that question. First of all, let's look at the real risk that exists in this kind of situation. Let's first look at the extent of the problem. That was specifically addressed in the Fort Worth Court of Appeals case KL, in which they addressed the ineffective assistance of counsel. And if I may, I'm just going to read just a short little excerpt from KL. The Fort Worth Court of Appeals said in their due process analysis, we recognize that in the vast majority of cases, counsel will render effective assistance and therefore ensure that the termination decision is accurate and just. So if we're looking at the extent of your concern about someone who is just absolutely incompetent, the risk of that is very minimal.
Well, so then we should have the right and enforce it, and it won't take any of our time.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
If we have the right and enforce it, it won't take any time, and it won't delay things at all.
No, that's not correct, Your Honor. Here's the problem. If you're first, you're looking at a very slight risk of error apparent because of the very few number of cases in which this might even be an issue. However, you're not just talking about the rights of the parent. What you're talking about is that the possibility, if you do say that there's ineffective assistance of counsel and it should be applied in these cases, what you're talking about is the same situation that the appellate courts are now looking at in criminal cases. In criminal cases, as an appellate attorney, you file an ineffective assistance of counsel claim as a matter of due course. And if you allow ineffective assistance of counsel in parental termination cases, then what you will have is you will have appellate attorneys in termination cases who will file these ineffective assistance of counsel claims as a matter of due course.
But surely it doesn't take too long to turn them down. How long does it take to say no?
Your Honor, it has to go to the appellate court.
You think there wouldn't be appeals on that?
Well,
that's your fear.
My problem is there is no way in the statute as it now exists to have anyone look at that issue other than appeal it as part of your issues that you're going to raise on appeal, and then it goes to the appellate court, and you're talking about the delay.
But isn't that an issue that got decided back when we decided we just didn't want innocent people going to jail?
Your Honor,
past that discussion, once you decided that you've got a constitutional right to be represented by counsel, don't we just take the problems of ineffective assistance of counsel, and that's just something we've got to live with because we err on the side of assuring that an innocent person doesn't go to jail?
Justice Enoch, you're correct, but you're looking at a criminal case.
Well, now we're talking about parental termination,
well,
parental rights. Hasn't the U.S. Supreme Court said that there is a context where the parents' right to raise their children rises maybe not all the way to loss of personal liberty, but it is a liberty interest that gets real close to there, that would say, well, if you're going to say you've got to have appointed counsel to represent a parent when these rights are at stake, don't we then say, well, wait a minute, we're kind of erring on the side that parents don't lose their right to children unless the state, by clear and convincing evidence, demonstrates that they're bad parents, and we're going to kind of err on the side of the child gets reunited with the parent.
There are, I believe, a couple of responses to that. First of all, you're talking about, when you talk about a liberty interest, in Lassiter, the Supreme Court specifically said, when you're talking about the Sixth Amendment, you are talking about actually being locked up, the loss of personal liberty. In fact, the Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel doesn't apply even in criminal cases in which you're not getting locked up. So there is one distinction. The second distinction is when you're talking about the allocation of burden, when you're talking about the time it's going to take to appeal this and who it affects. In a criminal case, you're talking about a criminal defendant who's been convicted, who's saying, I didn't get effective assistance of counsel.
It seems to me like all you're saying is because it takes a lot of time, we shouldn't recognize it, when that doesn't seem like the focus of our inquiry. It's been granted by statute, and I think in the prior case it was acknowledged that if we were to say, yes, there's a right to counsel in Texas, but not effective counsel, then we'd be alone among the states that have recognized the statutory right in saying that.
Justice O'Neill, that's not quite correct. I heard Mr. Hughes' response. In fact, there is a case called In Re Adoption of KLP. It is out of the Supreme Court of Illinois. It is a 2002 case, 763 Northeast 2nd 741. And I think it explains the differences that we're having here when you're talking about statutory entitlement to an attorney rather than constitutional entitlement. And what they say is, an indigent parent in a termination proceeding is entitled to court-appointed counsel, not because the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution mandates it, but because the legislature has chosen to guarantee the assistance of counsel to indigent parents rather than requiring courts to engage in the case-by-case determination that is set up in Lassiter. So the court, by the Texas legislature establishing 107.013, that does not mean that the Texas legislature says we recognize a constitutional right to effective counsel.
Did the Illinois court address whether or not there was a statutory right for that appointment to be meaningful?
No, they did not. They looked specifically at the constitutional right and said there was no constitutional right.
But we can
right.
agree, assuming we agree that the statute doesn't give rise to a constitutional right, it seems like the statute is pointless unless it means effective counsel. At some level, there's effectiveness inherently in that statute.
Your Honor, there are two Supreme Court cases that specifically address statutory entitlement to attorneys. They are Finley v. Philadelphia. If I can get that in my notes. It's Philadelphia v. Finley and Coleman v. Thompson. And both of those cases involve state appointment of counsel for post-conviction habeas proceedings. And in that, the Supreme Court in both cases found that there was no constitutional entitlement to...
But the question was, even if we agree with that,
yes.
We might think that the statute means, when it says counsel, competent counsel. Otherwise, what's the point of the statute? Apart from the Constitution.
That's true. Constitution. Your sister court, the Court of Criminal Appeals, has addressed that specific issue in Ex Parte Gray. And in fact, the statute, and it's a post-conviction habeas proceeding as well, and in fact, that criminal statute specifically says that they're entitled to competent counsel in the habeas proceeding. And what the Graves Court found is that there was not an entitlement to effective assistance.
Okay, let me ask
counsel.
You, on that point.
Yes.
On that point, was the court really acknowledging that there was not a constitutional right to counsel in the habeas? Or what are they saying? There's a statutory right, but not a constitutional right to counsel in habeas.
That they found that there was not a constitutional right.
Okay. Would the Court of Criminal Appeals come to the same conclusion if, under some circumstances, there was a constitutional right to counsel, but not necessarily all circumstances? Not necessarily under all circumstances were they entitled to constitutional right to counsel. And let me draw the analogy to the parental termination cases. There are some circumstances in which the parent would not be entitled to a constitutional right to counsel, but other circumstances where they would. Under those circumstances, if the legislature says, we don't want the courts deciding on a case-by-case basis if this is the case that gets constitutional interest, we're just going to say, if it's a parental termination case and they're indigent, they get counsel. Under those circumstances, isn't the better course for this court to decide, we're just going to apply ineffective assistance of counsel under those circumstances because it will apply in some cases, not necessarily in others, and we don't want to take our time trying to decide is this the type of case that gets ineffective assistance of counsel or not.
I think that is at the absolute crux of this question of this issue, and I want to. It's going to take me a couple of minutes to explain my answer, but I believe that the question that we have here. Is that parental rights are so important, and we've appointed counsel for them. Why shouldn't we give them the full protection afforded, at least analogous to the Constitution due process rights? And here is the answer that I would give that you cannot have ineffective assistance of counsel in parental termination cases. First of all, I go back to the answer that I gave Justice Heck, quoting the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, who said in the vast majority of cases, you don't have ineffective assistance of counsel. So you've got a very small number of cases, which in a due process analysis, You first look at the possibility of risk of error, and you look at that in the run-of-the-mill cases, not the rare exceptions. So when you're doing a due process analysis, and we're doing a quasi-due process analysis here, you first look at the problem that you're trying to address. So the risk is very minimal. There's a few number of cases.
So we accept in a few number of cases, children being removed from their parents with no basis in law, in fact, because of the incompetence of a lawyer. We just have to accept, the court has to accept that.
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. That's part of the balancing test when you're looking at competing rights. And there is a small risk of error.
In a civil case, in a regular civil case, if the lawyer commits malpractice, you can sue that lawyer and there's insurance, presumably, and you can recover. There's a remedy for that. But in these cases, let's assume that the lawyer makes just a grossest mistake, and as a result, the children are removed from parents in which they should not have been removed from. What's the remedy for that parent? You can't sue. I mean, you can sue the lawyer, but you don't get the kids back. So, how the court needs to address this somehow, don't you think?
One of the issues that you have is you have civil appointments, and civil appointments need to be addressed in civil remedies. And you have several civil remedies. First of all, it's the trial court who specifically appoints the attorneys to these cases, and in a lot of those areas, they have pools of attorneys that they appoint, and these people come in and they handle these cases on a regular basis. So my answer would be, instead of addressing this in an effective assistance of counsel in a parental termination case, this is better addressed in the civil procedures that are available, first of all, to the trial court. Trial court has the ability, if they appoint someone, as Justice Heck was talking about, who's absolutely totally incompetent, questionable if they ever would, but if they find that, the trial court first has the chance to redress that prior to the case ever going to trial. Second, you also have state bar remedies that can be addressed.
But I'm talking about the case where, let's say all those remedies are in place, but there's still someone slips through the cracks and that lawyer has been completely incompetent, waived error left and right, and resulting in children being removed from their parents when they shouldn't have been, under the law or under the facts. What is the remedy for that parent?
Your Honor, I'm not sure there is a remedy. But to be honest with you, I don't know if there is a remedy. However, when you're looking at this issue, you cannot let the possibility that one or two or a very small handful of cases in the next millennia will drive the policy of how these cases will be handled in the additional. And here's the reason. They have a process of ineffective assistance of counsel in California. And I use the term delay, Your Honor, and Justice O'Neill, and you said you keep talking about delay. Why is that important? The reason that is important is if you have delay in these cases, it's costing children. It's costing children. And I have here a quote. It's a fairly short block quote from a justice in the California Court of Appeals who's addressing the same issue that's on the flip side of trying to make sure, as you said, Justice Jefferson, we don't have anything slip through the cracks. The problem with trying to make sure that nothing slips through the cracks is exactly what's happened in California. And if I may, this is from N. Ray Micah S., 198 Cal App 3rd, 557. And this is Justice Breyer's concurrence. And this is what he said. Delay. An enormous quantum of delay is built into any system providing free counsel. And the problem was significantly exacerbated when incompetence of trial counsel became the most fashionable ploy of appellate lawyers. I have no doubt that the most serious bottleneck is the appeal, and that the plight of children in limbo cannot be ameliorated. Delay far beyond what the professional authorities consider acceptable is the rule rather than the exception in this field. Delay, by interfering with a new bonding, results in devastating psychological harm to children. The due process rights of parents clash with children's rights of at least equal dignity. Something must be done to afford these small human beings some chance of growth and a glimmer of future happiness. In termination proceedings, every right afforded the parents, and especially every appeal, is purchased at the expense of the person who is in law and morality the primary object of judicial solicitude, namely the child.
That's the answer to the whole problem, is that we got to speed things up. I mean, that's basically what we'll... Is that how we're going to look at all our statutes?
That's... Your Honor, that's... It's much more complex than that.
Actually,
in 1996, then-Governor Bush appointed a committee to look at the status of children in foster care in Texas. And the first thing they said is, these cases are taking too long.
All right, let's concede that it takes a long time.
Yes.
Tell me this. What has the state got in place in the event somebody does, as was described here, perform ineffectively or incompetently? What procedures does the state of Texas have in place to continue to protect the procedural due process rights of the parents?
Your Honor, there are, when you're looking at risk, the allocation of risk, the procedural process that we have set up is, it's very simple to file a motion for new trial. It's very simple to file the procedural thing that you need to file in order to preserve error.
But what if they don't do that?
Your Honor, there cannot be any system that absolutely negates all possibility of error.
Okay. Well, I'll concede.
Yes, we'll
give up on, there won't be a perfect trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
What further do we have to protect the best interests of the child?
Well, for one thing, Your Honor, there was a question by Justice Heck. Justice Heck asked, why does it take up to the 12-month period to get these to trial? The reason is because the statutes involving these family law cases have a series of temporary hearings that must be held. And in those, every hearing, there is an attorney for the children, there is a guardian ad litem for the children, there is an attorney for the parents. In a lot of cases, CASA is involved, and there is a judicial review of whether the child, in fact, the burden is, if the child isn't in danger, you have to send him home. So from the very removal of the child, the burden is on the state to prove that they should continue to have, I see my time has expired. May I complete the answer?
Yes, wrap it up quickly, because there's a few more questions.
Okay. In every step of the way along that full-year process, the state has to continue to prove that it needs to keep this child in its custody, in foster care. So from the very time the child is removed, there are procedures set up within the statute to protect the parent's rights.
You mentioned earlier in your quote from California that the children's rights were at least equal to those of the parents.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the Supreme Court has recognized a constitutionally protected right entitled to heightened scrutiny in parentage.
That's true, Your Honor.
Is there any corresponding constitutional right that has been recognized for a child to have the state monitor its home situation and remove it from a dangerous or harmful environment?
Or
is this merely an important statutory right? Are we balancing statute against constitution, or are there two constitutional rights?
We're balancing two constitutional rights.
Right, what's the child's constitutional right?
In Lassiter, the U.S. Supreme Court said child custody must be concluded as rapidly as is consistent with fairness for the sake of the child. In Lehman v. Lycoming County Children's Services Agency, which is another U.S. Supreme Court case, it recognized that children require secure, stable, long-term, continuous relationships. And extended uncertainty would be inevitable in many cases if you continue on with an appeal.
But just give me a constitutional provision.
Your Honor, the courts have recognized that in Stankowski, and in Stanley, that the child has also as important right.
Just give me the constitutional provision. Is it due process?
It's a liberty interest.
I thought the court had said we should not presume that the child's interests are at odds with the parent.
that there is that initial, there's an interest in all parties, both the private parties, the parent and the child, also in the state, that you have a just and accurate result. And it is true that because you, the first belief is that a child is best off with his parent,
that's the presumption.
That's a presumption that goes through the law. However, once you have a removal under the statute saying that to place the child back would endanger the child or would endanger the welfare, then you also the child has a liberty interest.
But at every stage, as you pointed out, the legislature, and I thought the U.S. Supreme Court as well, said it's the state's burden to continue to prove at every turn that the parent doesn't get the child back, that the state has the right to keep the child in the child's best interest. It's always the state's burden. It's never the parent's burden to prove I get my child back.
That's correct. But it is a liberty interest for the child to have the right to be in a stable environment. And as that statute said, the right of a child, or the case out of California, the right of a child to be in a stable environment and to be protected is at least as important as the parent's right. And, Your Honor, there's a...
I think I've heard enough.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. A couple points, I'll be brief. The risk of time, while we understand that children do need some finality to things, the risk of a wrongful termination is also an unjust result.
Can I ask you a question? Would you hold retained counsel to the same duty as appointed counsel?
In a termination case, yes, sir.
All right. So basically, we would need to review those two. We would be opening up a situation where we'd need to be taking a look at those activities. Any difference in the standard of review?
Not that I'm aware of. I think it's the same. The termination part of it is what bothers me, as the judge over here said, that, you know, in a civil case, you can go sue him, maybe get you some insurance money, but in a termination case, you just can't go sue your attorney and go get your kids back.
Would you equate reversible error with ineffective assistance?
Yes. Would I?
Yes.
Yes.
If I'm accused of a crime and I hire a stupid counsel, is the court going to take care of me on appeal and let me have another cut?
No. I don't believe that's the way it is now, Judge.
So you want a higher burden in these cases?
Yes, sir. Just losing your kids, you know? I mean, to me, that's the worst thing that possibly happened to a parent.
What about losing them another way? I mean, not just the parents losing them, but maybe they would be in a situation. Oh, you know what the argument is. If they were in a bad situation, you'd lose them that way too, wouldn't you?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
The only other response I have is the ex parte Graves, the 1107-1 writ. I'd point out that by the time we get to post-conviction habeas, he's already had trial counsel and appellate counsel that were both under effective assistance of counsel dictated. Outside that, unless you have any questions, I have nothing to add.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes today's arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.